Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Maybe you noted the fact and remembered it that Taiwan shut down its airport last December 31st on solid intelligence that an odd strain of pneumonia had hit 27 Chinese people near Wuhan. I missed the news, but the governments in Japan, South Korea, Hong Kong, Singapore, Australia, and New Zealand did not. Perhaps because they keep a wary eye on China. Perhaps because they heard an echo of the SARS epidemic from 2003, but they acted. From the very start of this year, 2020, countries in East Asia were closing their gates, watching for symptoms and sufferers, and they never let up. The results get more striking every week. A death rate from COVID-19 close to zero in Vietnam, roughly 3 in a million people dying in Japan, Thailand, China itself, or about 1% of the rate of fatal cases in France, Italy, Spain, and the eastern seaboard of the United States. Even now, do we know what East Asia did right? What the best of American medicine did not learn about defanging COVID-19? Our keynote guest this hour, Dr. Jim Kim, former president of the World Bank, made his professional name as a doctor of global medicine and an aggressive interventionist in pandemics from HIV/AIDS to Ebola. Jim Kim is a principal advisor now to the governor of Massachusetts, Charlie Baker, in the COVID crisis, and he says Americans are still not doing nearly enough.
This virus has simply revealed the weaknesses and strengths of various healthcare systems. And so if you were to say, has Asia done better? Overall, you could say yes. But the reason for that is that they've had experiences that just literally scared the hell out of them. So in Korea, for example, in 2014, they had an outbreak of MERS, the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome. They were so scared because the death rate of MERS is closer to 30%. Now, MERS doesn't transmit very well, and they had less than 50 cases. But that scared them so much that they said, we will never be surprised again. And they enacted a different set of laws so that when an epidemic hits, the laws change. And then all of a sudden, the Korean government can get access to not only your GPS data, but can get access to your credit card records as a part of their contact tracing program. You know, there's a lot of talk about what's going on in China, but the fact that they got the curve down so quickly in Wuhan, this is probably one of the most misunderstood pieces of the whole coronavirus puzzle. The most optimistic view in the West of what's going to happen in the West coming out of the University of Washington basically said, well, what happened in Wuhan will happen in the United States. And of course, it's not. And that model has already been proven to be, you know, quite questionable, because the reason that the outcomes were better in Asia is they not only did the social distancing, and they did it often much more strictly than the United States, but in some cases, they did it less strictly. In Singapore, in Korea, they did it less strictly. But what they all had in common is that they tested much more broadly. They traced contacts. In other words, whenever there's a positive case, they would go and find out all the people that that positive case had been in touch with, and then they quarantined them. In other words, got them out of circulation until they knew whether they were positive or negative. And then when they found people who were positive, they isolated them. Isolation is the word we use for separating people who are proven to be positive. And they quarantined, which is the word we use for people who are suspected to be positive. We quarantined them in places where we knew they were not going to transmit the infection. You see, Chris, the whole point is stopping the transmission and the social distancing part. And this is what the Asian countries that have been successful, this is what all of them knew. They knew that social distancing would only go so far. Social distancing can stop transmission between households. But then what happens in every place, what's happening in Spain and Italy now, is that the vast majority of the cases then start coming from transmission within households. Social distancing alone cannot stop transmission within households. For that, you need testing, tracing, isolation, and quarantine.
But there's another big question here. There's a myth in America that we wouldn't want to put up with that effective a system. that it would interfere with our individualism or something. I wonder about that premise to begin with.
Chris, I'm an old TB person. In the United States, for tuberculosis patients that are actively infectious and that are out there coughing on people and refuse to take their medicines, there is a law that says that we can send them. I mean, it's the Shattuck Hospital in Boston. I have sent people to the Shattuck Hospital in Boston, people who are actively infecting others with tuberculosis and refuse to take their medicine. So there are laws in the U.S. Now, if you are sick with an airborne infectious pathogen that can then infect and kill others, then effectively you are breaking the law if you refuse to take your medicine. I think this is so much bigger. It's going to be well nigh impossible, I think, to have mandatory isolation or quarantine. But the thing that we found in Massachusetts in doing these first calls that we've been doing with the contact tracing program is that when things are explained to people, the choice that people make is usually to protect their family members. Often in small apartments where there are many people living there, if we were to offer very nice accommodations, whether it's in a college dorm room or in a hotel, and provide food and medical oversight, even for the provision of medicines if necessary, we found that the majority of people, the vast majority of people, will choose that option in order to protect their families. And that's what we need to see. We need to see a lot of voluntary movements out of danger situations so that we can stop transmission of the virus. To think that just by staying off the streets and staying at home for the most part and wearing masks is going to stop transmission is just a fantasy. You've got to actually take those steps that we know have worked for more than 100 years. I mean, these isolation, quarantine protocols have been around for more than 100 years. You know, we know that they work. You've got to put those into place in addition to the social distancing to stop the transmission.
The lesson of your experience, and it's vast, is hunt it down, and it can be done. Meantime, we have this incredible anomaly in the numbers. And surely nobody is saying, oh, well, that's the American way. Just let the thing run.
So, Chris, let's just do a little contrast. Let's compare the Korea response with a New York City response. Look, I'm a great admirer of Governor Cuomo. I think,
me too,
given the tools that he had and given how far the disease had progressed by the time they really had any testing, it's hard to blame him. But just let's just compare the response of New York, say, even 2 weeks ago, before the testing ramp up. So in Korea, if you have any symptom at all, right, you put it onto your computer and nobody comes, tests you. And then the minute that you could be a potential case, before even the test gets back, they get in touch with all the people you've been in contact with, using everything from GPS on your phone to your credit card number. All of those people are then put in some form of quarantine, and then they test all the people they've been in contact with.
Right.
That net goes out really broadly, because the idea is that even someone just with suspicious symptoms, you've got to stop that chain of transmission.
Right. And it's called sort of rule by Google or, you know, Apple, and some people profess to hate it.
It's not. I mean, for them, yes, they're using some apps, but the human touch is incredibly important. An app will never do this for you. You've got to have an army of people actually making the phone calls. This is something that we've learned. And it's something that, in fact, that's how it happens in most of Asia. You have to have people at the core. There's no system that's completely gone to apps. I hope the apps are going to be helpful. I know that the people are going to be helpful. So then let's compare to New York. In New York, up until a couple of weeks ago, and this was when the epidemic was absolutely raging in the state of New York and in the city of New York, the only way you could get a test is if you had the virus, were suspicious of having the virus, and were sick and in the hospital. So if you were at home and you called somebody and said, I think I have symptoms of coronavirus, you could not get a test. They would say, well, stay at home and try to separate yourself from your family members, right? That's the difference. That's why the numbers got so high, because we were not doing the full public health response. I have to say, I think we as a public health community have to take some responsibility for that. I couldn't believe, Chris, how quickly we gave up on doing the full public health response. It was, again, to be fair, we didn't have any testing. The testing has been a fiasco, and we still don't have anywhere near enough testing. But the public health community basically said, well, because there's community transmission, we can't contain the virus like they do in Asia anymore. All we can do is shelter in place and try to mitigate. That's the term.
Yeah, the line was, it was too late to go out and figure out who you crossed the street, you know, and saw who might have been sick, hundreds of people. But is that a proper despair or not?
You know, Chris, there's still a lot of confusion because people are saying, well, we need testing. And, you know, I agree with that. But then the question is, well, so then what's the strategy? The strategy now includes contact tracing, but they're only saying you need contact tracing when you open up the economy again. But in fact, let me just quote to you the guy who has responded to every Ebola outbreak since the first one, a guy named Dr. Mike Ryan, who's now head of epidemic response at the World Health Organization. He put it this way to all the member states of WHO. He said, for those of you who have just a few cases, there's only one way to prevent having a mountain of cases. Mm-hmm. And that is the social distancing, testing, contact tracing, and then isolation and quarantine. Now, he said, for those of you who are sitting on top of a mountain of cases, the only way down from the mountain of cases is exactly the same. You've got to put all those pieces in place. And so what you're seeing in Massachusetts, in New York, what you're seeing in Spain and Italy, places that only did the social distancing, you're seeing the flattening of the curve, and then the reproductive number, the number of additional cases from every new case, is plateauing right at around one. And as far as I can tell, in terms of all the data that we've gotten in so far, it will stay at around one for a very long time. It will not go down unless you put these other measures in place. We're not there yet, Chris. We have not yet gotten our head around the enormity of the challenge in front of us in the United States. Now, earlier in the program, Chris, you said that these countries have defeated the virus. They haven't. The thing that you'll see if you talk to the health authorities in China or Taiwan or Hong Kong or South Korea is that they're saying it's okay for now, but we are absolutely on the alert because we know this virus is nasty. It spreads so quickly and it spreads silently, you know, among people who don't have symptoms. So they are on hyper alert. Taiwan started, I mean, they've absolutely shut down the virus and they've started their baseball season, but they've got these incredible means of isolating their baseball players and they do it to an empty stadium. So they figured out how to sort of move back toward normal, but they're only confident in moving back to normal because they have this enormous public health infrastructure that will be ready to pounce on anyone with symptoms. And I don't mean pounce in a negative way. They're going to find everyone with symptoms. They're going to test them. They're going to get to all their contacts. They're going to isolate and quarantine. And they're going to try to snuff out every single outbreak so that they can continue to move on this path toward normalcy.
Coming up, a case history in virus hunting, how Australia got it virtually all right. This is Open Source. On the vast island continent of Australia, authorities think they're on the verge of extinguishing the last traces of coronavirus. They did it by the book, as the medical historian Warwick Anderson explains to us. If they made one major mistake, it was when they closed their borders to foreigners and made an exception for Americans.
We in Australia are very pleased with how the epidemic has been managed so far. We can even contemplate eliminating the virus altogether from Australia, as the New Zealanders claim they've done across the Tasman. Is a tremendous achievement to get to that point. It was, I think, the result of a much more rationalised policy environment to start with. Somewhat to our surprise, our Prime Minister, who didn't heed the advice of experts on climate change, quite readily seemed to be prepared to follow the advice of expert epidemiologists and public health officers. Fairly early, when we'd heard about what was happening in China, the Australian government did begin to pay attention very early on and treat it, the potential epidemic at the time.
Did you close your airports the way Taiwan did?
We didn't quite close the airports. What we did was close the airports to flights from certain countries, including China, very early on. But the airports are still open, but only Australian citizens and residents or people with some other good cause can go through the airports. And anyone who does go through now has to be quarantined for 14 days in a hotel paid for by the government. And that's very strict. It's enforced very strictly. We would have done even better, I think, if we'd closed the borders to Americans. That was the problem, because most of the infections in Australia have come from Americans travelling here or Australians who've been to America, rather than from China. But the problem was that we trusted the US government when they said that there wasn't much SARS-CoV-2 in the US because you weren't testing. And so it was a bit like Indonesia. Indonesia even now claims there's not much SARS-CoV-2 in Indonesia because they don't test. If you don't test, you won't find it, obviously. One of the few mistakes we made was not closing the borders to America earlier. But aside from that, I mean, we did get on top of the issue of importation fairly well. There are some exceptions, the most notable being the disaster of the Ruby Princess, a cruise ship that docked in Sydney Harbour, and there are numerous inquiries into that now, but a substantial proportion of the cases in Australia have come from that boat. The authorities, federal and state, allowed people off when they should perhaps have waited a few more days when the positive tests came through.
So you were fortunate to escape that bomb in a sense, but what else were you doing in the way of social distancing, in the way of tracking connections, this sort of thing?
This is very important. I think very early people started to emphasize the importance of what's called social distancing. It's really, I think, should be called physical distancing, obviously. We say, in general, 1.5 meters. I think you say 6 feet over there. That was emphasized very early, and along with rigorous hand washing and hand sanitizing. That was done very early on. Then in late March, around the 22nd of March, I think, the governments all got together and said that they were going to have to close down a number of non-essential businesses, or at least limit access to these businesses. Interestingly, our shutdown, such as it is, has never been as severe as in parts of North America and parts of Western Europe. In fact, you can still go to, say, a furniture store, which I did a few days ago, but you have to make an appointment and they let people in one by one. And you can, but these sort of stores are still operating, along with, of course, all the grocery stores. And the restaurants are closed, the bars are closed, the pubs are closed. Virtually everything else was left to operate, but in a restricted way. People did respect requirements of physical distancing and rigorous hand washing and cleaning. So that has helped a lot. The fact that we did this early, it was good too. But I think one of the more important aspects of this has been the coordination of all the states and territories with the federal government. They meet, I think, every week now. All the leaders meet weekly via Zoom or whatever, if they're still doing that. And they also, separately, all the chief health officers, the chief medical officers of each state, territory, federally, meet almost every day, I think, to discuss the latest figures, to work out policies. The governments have fairly rigorously, meticulously even, followed the advice of the health officers. From the beginning, there was an emphasis on, first of all, securing the borders. Then testing was regarded as being absolutely crucial.
Did you have the technology from day one?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we did. We didn't make the mistake that the CDC did and try to invent our own, but we did have that. There were concerns, of course, about resilience, I suppose, in the sense of the hospital system and the medical system more generally, whether that would be overwhelmed and therefore testing would be difficult, but also treatment, of course, would be incredibly challenging, if not impossible. There was a great rush, as everywhere else, to find ventilators and to retrain people in intensive care. We haven't actually needed it, which is good. But we were prepared. We had enough ventilators. We had enough intensive care beds to meet even the worst projection. So this was done very early on. The testing and case tracing has been extraordinary. It's been impeccable. And that has meant that when people do get COVID-19, we think we're getting all of them, but maybe not. We'll find out. But at the moment, it looks as though we're doing enough testing to find all of them. And the testing keeps on being ramped up. And virtually everyone will get a test eventually. And then if any cases are detected, then they're isolated and their contacts are traced to suppress the outbreak. There have been a few outbreaks in a nursing home in north of Sydney, which is continuing, and also in northwest Tasmania in a hospital there, the latter from a Ruby Princess passenger who was treated there. But the one in Tasmania has been contained now, it seems, and I think the one in North Sydney soon will be. But it means that we're down now with all this intensive testing. We're finding about 10 cases nationally. It's in a population of 25 million, which is probably this New York State's population, roughly. We're finding 10 cases of, 10 infections with SARS-CoV-2. That's across the whole country. Now, ultimately, we're hoping that we'll find none for a long period of time, and we could say then that the virus has been eliminated and we can remove all restrictions, one hopes, at that stage, and see what happens. As long as the testing continues, we'll see if we missed any. It also means, of course, that for the foreseeable future, our borders will have to be closed.
Warwick Anderson, you're in an interesting position there in Australia to survey the moral burdens on this whole story, on China for suppressing the first evidence of the story, gets enormous credit for crushing the disease eventually. In the West, what do we make of our own responsibility for letting the virus run rampant? Who's on the hook here?
Before I get onto that, Chris, if I may, just to add to what I said before, I think it would be interesting for your listeners in the US to know that from the beginning, the health experts in Australia have said, do not wear masks in public.
Really?
Do not wear masks. Now, they, of course, insist on people who are symptomatic with COVID-19 or indeed any respiratory illness, one imagines, that they wear masks. And of course, if you're in close contact as someone treating somebody with this illness, you'd wear a mask too. They've always said that in public, it is not necessary to wear masks. That's, I think, very interesting, given the almost the fetish about masks in the US, the great sense that a mask is a sort of talisman that would provide some magical protection. It's nice to have a sense of control that wearing a mask may give, but it's a danger if that means you don't do the things that really matter, such as keep your distance from others, but also have meticulous hand hygiene. So you have to do that, because that's going to matter a lot more than wearing a mask. And it wasn't because there was a shortage of masks, not at all. It was just that it was seen that masks were not effective. There's new information that maybe asymptomatic carriers of SARS-CoV-2 could be shedding it, but the evidence isn't strong. And even if that were a factor, it's not a major factor in the spread of the epidemic. Certainly it hasn't mattered here. We've managed to get to a point where we're contemplating the elimination of this terrible virus without wearing masks. The other thing that's, I think, of interest to you listeners, perhaps, is that we've mostly kept the schools open, although they're very poorly attended. Parents aren't willing to send their kids to school because of their apprehensions. But the schools have been open for those who want to send their children there.
Come back to the broadest general view you can of who's on the hook. Where does the moral burden lie for this very strange history?
Well, I think what happened in China is deplorable for two reasons. One is that the Chinese government allowed the conditions for the emergence of this virus and its transfer to humans, allowed those conditions to flourish in the wildlife wet markets in China. It's been known for decades that eventually some particularly lethal virus would emerge from such conditions. So that should never have been allowed to happen. Anyone with a basic understanding of disease ecology, of One Health, of the ease at which pathogens are transmitted from non-human animals to humans and stuff, could have told the Chinese government that they were running a terrible risk here. Mind you, they're not alone in doing that, but that was a terrible thing to happen. And also not being transparent and open initially was a problem. But ultimately, each nation, and it's very interesting how this has been a sort of a nation-based response, right, unlike the more global response to SARS earlier. But each nation, too, has made its mistakes. So even Australia and New Zealand, we've made a few errors of judgment. There are some, obviously, who are doing a lot worse. And the virus is a great index of this. I mean, the virus transmission is a wonderful index of how you're doing as a nation state. And certainly it's very concerning what's happening in places like the United States now, where there is inadequate testing, case tracing.
I'd love the most judicious view you can give us from Australia, the island nation of Australia, of who's on the hook here for this incredibly mixed record of a dangerous disease.
Well, I think we all have to ask ourselves how we ought to manage these things and think whether our governments have actually done the right thing here. And I think the lessons of the epidemic are that one should heed experts. One should follow the science. One should also be in a situation where you haven't let your national infrastructure run down to the extent it is in the United States and similarly in Indonesia, where you just can't respond adequately to these entirely predictable epidemics. I see in the New York Times and elsewhere that a lot of people are blaming Trump. I can understand that. But I think he's more a symptom than a cause of these problems. For a long time, the US, like many other countries, has failed to invest in public health and other medical infrastructure the way it should. And that ultimately explains the predicament those countries are in, not the fact that it originated in one place or another. It's what happened when it got to the country that matters. And you just need to look at Australia and New Zealand. I mean, we got the same virus from the same place, but we managed it completely differently.
What's your model performance in this sorry history?
The governments that have followed expert advice are the ones that we should esteem, really. All the governments in Australia, it's a federal system like the US, and the government of New Zealand have assiduously followed expert advice, have followed the science. But also, I think you have to pay a tribute to those who, over many decades, have maintained a proper health infrastructure. And that has been done more or less in Australia. There have been a few deficiencies revealed by this epidemic, but not as many as in many parts of Western Europe and North America. I mean, I think there are always going to be mistakes made, but in general, I think in Australia, we've done very well in trying to understand this rationally and intervene effectively with the resources that we've developed over the years.
We don't know quite what the future is going to be, but who will lead us there?
That's a very difficult question to answer. I mean, I think that, we're concerned here, even in Australia, that this may have just been one unusual episode when the federal government has actually decided to heed the advice of scientists and experts that once this is over, once the crisis has passed, they'll go back to their old ways of doing things in a much more partisan and ideologically charged fashion. So I don't know whether the people who've emerged to lead us out of this pandemic in Australia will still be worth following when it's over. So I think the world will be a very different place, and who knows who will emerge as leaders afterwards. I just hope that the ones who do lead us will be the ones who respect science and expertise and have a broad commitment to making sure our governments are effective.
Can China regain its leadership?
Well, I think it hasn't really lost its leadership in a way. It's still an economic powerhouse. I think it'll get through this and still be incredibly influential on most of the world. partly because of the financial investments it's made in so much of the world, has it lost its moral authority? I don't know that it ever operated through moral authority. Its role as an economic powerhouse has meant that many people have paid tribute to it. The question is, really, can the United States ever regain its moral leadership in as much as it had it? And again, I don't think one can just blame Trump. I think generally, for at least from a distance, I'm not there. I haven't been able to experience what you've gone through. But from a distance, it all looks like a shambles over there from top to bottom. And I just find it very concerning. I don't know how the US got to that point. I've been waiting for someone to draw a comparison between the US and Indonesia. Both countries have a similar population. And everyone expects the Indonesians to have a hopeless health infrastructure and to listen to religious authorities above scientific authorities. That's to be expected, but we do tend to expect more from the United States.
Warwick Anderson, thank you.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure talking with you, and I do hope things improve there rapidly.
Warwick Anderson is the MD who wrote the books, several of them, on the history of medicine and public health in Australasia. He teaches at the University of Sydney. Coming up, Dr. Jim Kim, back with us, looks for those sensitive American borders around public health and personal freedom. This is Open Source. Dr. Jim Kim is not shy about sounding relentless on pandemics, about pouncing on the last virus, like the last cat on the last mouse. I asked him, does he suppose that Americans worry that at the end of the process, they're going to feel that we've lost our freedom somehow, that the virus is gone, but it's not us anymore?
Chris, we have to find a way to do it with people not losing their freedom. And it just means being extremely creative. You know, the Koreans did this very differently than the Chinese. The Taiwanese also did it differently. In Hong Kong, they did it differently. You know, there are all kinds of ways of doing this without doing things in a military or mandatory way. And that's the innovation challenge for us, right? So I'm not at all advocating that we, you know, go into some sort of military state. Not at all. I have to be really clear about that. What we're doing in Massachusetts is trying to figure out what is the right way of presenting information, of creating kinds of situations where people will voluntarily go in for isolation and quarantine because, one, we take good care of them when they're there, and two, they feel great about protecting their family members, their loved ones, from being infected. I think we can find a way to do that without being heavy-handed. That's really the challenge. It's not that, you know, this is not a simple process at all. It's something that we've tried again and again and again. Every society, every culture will do it a little bit differently. We've just got to find the right way for Massachusetts first and then for other states as well.
This is fantastically interesting, Dr. Jim Kim, and I'm so glad you're working on the scene in Massachusetts. But go back to, as if it were day one, this discovery of perfectly public numbers in East Asia that are so much better than ours in controlling the deaths from the disease. Obviously, it helps to have gotten a jump early. It helps to have had SARS to remind you of the incredible threat here. It helps to have built up an effective public health infrastructure. What else should we be learning about practical devices, but also moral credit here?
Yeah. So, my friend and former head of the CDC, Tom Frieden, just published a very interesting article yesterday, and he pointed out that public health people have been the Eeyores, you know, from the Winnie the Pooh story, the Eeyores of the healthcare community.
The stubborn old mule.
Yeah. Well, but also, you know, oh, woe is me and it rains only on me, et cetera, right?
Right.
And he pointed out that in 2018, the United States spent $11,000 per person on healthcare, medical care, and $286 per person on public health. So we have been underspending on public health for a very long time. There's been report after report after report saying we are ill prepared for a real pandemic. You know, we need to invest much, much more in our public health systems. We need to put many more people on standby to respond to public health problems, and we're not there. And so, you know, the way we see the situation in Massachusetts, by the way, we've had 35,000 applications, Chris. Contact tracing, the contact tracing positions, we've had 35,000 applications in Massachusetts. Part of them are people who need jobs, but part of them are people who are just excited about going on the offensive, you know, going after this and trying to attack the virus. And so what we're going to need is a very solid baseline system. And then almost like a volunteer fire crew, people who know enough about contact tracing, who know enough about public health, so that if something happens like this again, we can quickly scale up and have a lot of people out there attacking this virus. You know, I think part of the issue was that in the US, we just never really believed that something like SARS or Ebola, we just never really believed that it could happen to us. True. That somehow the sophistication of the medical system would solve it. But, you know, we put out report after report after report. The latest one actually came out of the World Bank before I left in October of 2018. And it basically said, boy, countries are incredibly ill-prepared for a real pandemic. They need to do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the same things that we've been saying for a long time. And so I, you know, just like air travel was never the same after 9/11, I just think, you know, the whole field of healthcare and public health will never be the same. I think we're going to have to build systems that are ready for something this nasty, this infectious, this lethal.
Fascinating. You know, 4 months in or 2 months into the heightened public consciousness of the whole thing, I'm still confused about who's ahead, who's done well, who hasn't. Here I am celebrating the record in East Asia, but I'm also wondering, in your view, who is still on the hook for neglect of evidence, denial of the reality of it, or for unpreparedness in general, a sort of willful neglect of a undeniable threat? Where's the moral burden for all of this, you know, all of this history so far?
Well, Chris, you know, once in a while I sit down and I think about that, but then I get too busy, you know, just trying to focus on the mass program. Or, you know, we're now beginning to work with Ohio and Illinois, we meaning Partners in Health, beginning to work with the city of Newark. There's just so many things that are going on. And I think we'll have time to do that kind of accounting soon. You know, we're always late with responses to pandemics, but then we catch up. We have caught up to now. Now, the thing that's holding us back is that there's this just incredible wishful thinking that the curve has flattened and the University of Washington tells us it's going to go down. And, oh, we think it's going to go down below one. We think it's going to start. I just think that if that happens, that would be great. Mm-hmm. But it would probably mean that the virus has changed. All the evidence from the world tells us right now that unless we adopt this full strategy, we are not going to see that curve going down. And so I hope the country wakes up, but I listen to the news all the time, Chris, and people are still saying, well, we need testing, and gee, we hope the curve starts going downward. What people should be saying is the curve's not going to go downward until we get much more aggressive tackling the virus.
Jim Kim, I so admire your reluctance to point fingers, make moral judgments. History will sort it out. But meantime, to me, one of the most worrisome things is this kind of stereotyping of nations, cultures. China has a dirty street culture. They could have done something about the live animal markets, you know, moons ago. Or that the United States is just being slovenly about this, doesn't get it. Or God knows the more exotic conspiracy theories about who planted this problem. What do we do about that, of dampening the personal and culturally specific stereotyping and blaming, and most of it just folklore, hatred, looking for a place to land?
I like to think that part of it's because we're just not busy enough, and we need to get much, much busier actually fighting the virus, right? This is going to take a lot of work. It's going to take a whole of society approach. There's an acute awareness in Korea about where the virus is, where it could be, where I've been, where people who have the virus have been. They live with the virus as if it were a, you know, nasty creature that's out there that they know they're in a life and death fight with, right? You know, for us, it's so passive still. The only thing we're told to do is to not do things. It's only negative what we do. There's nothing positive that we do in fighting the virus. And so I think that's really the shift that's got to happen. And, you know, let me just say a few things, though. I'm an Asian American, and I grew up in Iowa, and I lived through every single Asian stereotype and slur and name-calling experience that you could ever imagine. And I worry about the rise of that sort of thing. You know, Chinese were the only ones that were completely excluded, only a group that was completely excluded from citizenship starting back in 1882. So anti-Asian sentiment, the so-called yellow peril, this stuff is not gone. It's not gone. And so I think that we will find that every country made mistakes in this pandemic. But, you know, what I keep reminding people is, you know, whatever else you want to say about China, from the perspective of someone who's cared about poverty and tried to fight against poverty for, you know, most of my adult life, China lifted 800 million people out of poverty, and they shut down the Wuhan epidemic in a way that still there's nobody in the world that's shut down an epidemic that big, that quickly, right? So I would say that wouldn't it make sense to learn from the Wuhan experience? Whatever else you think about China as a country, you know, first of all, don't let it extend to every person who looks like me, frankly. And it's very disturbing the extent to which I'm hearing that, you know, that anti-Asian racism is getting worse in the United States, as if folks needed an excuse to do that. I'm very concerned about it. But I think it's just idiotic not to look at this country that took a raging epidemic and set it down to understand what happened and what they did. Knowing, of course, that we're not going to use the same procedures. We have to do it in a way that reflects our culture, our ethical and moral systems. But, you know, we've done harder things, Chris. We've done harder things before. You know, it's like when President Kennedy said, hey, we're going to go to the moon, right? I just can't imagine the folks at NASA saying, yeah, but it's so far, it's so hard, it's so complicated. How can we do that? They just said, okay, right? That might not have been their top priority at NASA, but they said, okay, let's figure it out.
No, this is wonderful to hear and deeply challenging. I'm immediately reminded, though, also of President Kennedy in his American University speech in 1963, not just months really before his death, but in which he said, we've got to get to know the Russians in a different way. And the communist thing is kind of worn out as a tag. If we thought about what they suffered in World War II, which would have devastated almost a quarter of our country, if we knew what they'd suffered in World War II, we would think again about those people. It seems to me there's a tremendous creative challenge here. It's certainly within American power creatively to reconceive a relationship with China and their incredible accomplishments and their history. Not to make it, you know, pure romance, but to re-engineer that relationship in spirit, in culture, in fact. Who would you designate to say, that's your assignment, rethink our relationship with the East?
Well, there are plenty of people, you know, who are already doing that. And, you know, it's the second largest, and may, after this crisis, you know, be clearly the largest economy in the world. There's enormous innovation coming out of China. There are kinds of business models that are coming out of China. I mean, Alibaba, Tencent, these folks, they may be defining what business is going to look like in much of the developing world going forward. There's so much going on there that I just think it's a huge mistake just to, you know, again, some of the language coming out of the U.S. government, it's very concerning because it doesn't seem to stick with specific things that they do. It seems to suggest that there are things that they are that have led to this, that, and the other. And that's just a tiny little toe step away from racism. And I think that for a lot of people in the United States, it gets there and it doesn't make any sense. I think as a people, I mean, as getting to know not just China, but all of Asia, it's just a no-brainer because they're going to be the economies that get back in full swing, you know, far sooner than I think Europe and the United States. And I'm saying that partly because they've got the full system in place. They may have to go on lockdown in parts of Asia again, but they have the confidence to know that when they open things up, they have the troops that can go down and stop outbreaks the minute they happen. We don't have that confidence, neither does most of Europe, right? And so if you're just looking from now forward, it makes a lot of sense to understand what's going on in Asia. It's going to be critical if you're interested in keeping your economy going.
Absolutely. It's a great gift to show American businesses, farms, all sorts of enterprises, how to get going again with a very careful monitoring of this disease. And Asia seems to know how to do it.
It's not so much that Asia knows how to do it. I just think that because these guys have experienced these incredibly scary outbreaks like SARS and MERS, right? Because they've had that experience. And, you know, if you look back at the United States, there's just so many more cases. But I guess the only thing I would say is, well, yeah, there are a lot more cases in the United States, and it's going to be much harder. It's going to be the largest, most difficult, most complex project that I've ever worked on. And I've worked on some big ones, Chris. You know, HIV treatment for all of Africa was a pretty big one. This is much bigger, much more complicated, much more difficult. But we don't have a choice. You know, you have to wait and hope for a vaccine. And I'm hopeful that we'll get one. But even if there is a vaccine, vaccines are difficult to make. Vaccines are difficult to produce. You know, usually it's a vial with liquid that goes in the vial. And, you know, often you have to have a syringe that takes the liquid from the vial and puts it into people. And sometimes if it's something you give by mouth, the vials that you take the liquid from has to be refrigerated. There's complexities here. So it's going to be a while. In the meantime, we've got a tool that has been proven in country after country, including Australia and New Zealand, which is the full public health response. That's what we've got to do. And by the way, you know, if you want to loosen your lockdown restrictions, the White House says you've got to have testing and contact tracing in place. So just do it. Do it anyway. And then if this keeps coming back year after year, we're going to have to stand up the system so that every single year it's ready to pounce on new cases and shut down outbreaks wherever they happen and keep people in the United States safe.
That's an inspirational challenge, Dr. Kim. I mean it. Give us an assignment for the first week in May, even here in Massachusetts. What do we got to do first?
So first and foremost, right? For anyone who's being contacted by our contact tracing system, answer the call, right? On your phone, the phrase is something like Mass Contact Tracing Collaborative. So it'll come up on your phone. Everybody answer the call. And then as we get going, we're looking for ways of providing wonderful spaces so that people can isolate and quarantine effectively. Then you have to respect the social distancing requirements. Remember, the social distancing requirements, they do work. They don't work very well inside families, but they do work to prevent spread between families. Please, please respect those considerations and support the system, right? There are people who are saying, contact tracing, this is terrible. This is getting rid of our civil liberties. Well, we are doing everything we can to protect civil liberties while at the same time preventing people from transmitting the virus. So everyone get on board the project of stopping transmission. That's why they're successful in Korea. That's why they're successful in China. That's why they're successful in Australia and New Zealand. There's a sense that everyone is working together to stop even one transmission. The more people can do that, the quicker we're going to see that curve coming down, the quicker we're going to be able to get back to what is a normal life. You know, Chris, people ask me, how soon are we going to be able to loosen restrictions and get back to a normal life? And for me, the answer is fairly simple. I think the evidence is overwhelming that says that the minute we're testing everyone we need to test, we're tracing every single contact that those people who are positive have had. We're making sure that every single person has effective isolation and quarantine so that they're not infecting anyone else. The minute we have that system in place, maybe a month and a half or 2 months after that, we can think about really opening up the economy. And that's the best answer I have. So that's the assignment, folks. If we can get those systems in place, then maybe 2 months after that, we can really start looking at opening things up.
Mm. Dr. Jim Kim, you're my kind of doctor. I'm so grateful to have you on Open Source. It's a privilege to hear you out at length in detail from a long career at the forefront of this field. Thank you, and keep doing what you're doing.
Thanks, Chris. Great to talk to you.
Thanks also to Warwick Anderson in Sydney, down under. Keep track of all our corona coverage at radioopensource.org. And if you like it, please think of supporting us on Patreon. You can hear Adam Coleman's series of conversations with writers thinking hard about social isolation this week. Barry Lamb, the host of Slate's philosophy podcast called Hi-Fi Nation. Our show is produced by Connor Gillies and Adam Coleman and the artist Susan Coyne, all at a safe distance. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath traces all our contacts. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time on Open Source.
Hub
and Spoke. Audio Collective.